Since partly because today is Valentine's Day, I thought it would be nice to talk about metta, or loving kindness. And I'd like to begin by reading the discourse on loving kindness that goes back to the Buddha. And it's called the Discourse on Loving Kindness, and it's often referred to as as one of the primary sources for the practice of loving kindness. However, in its thrust, or in the main emphasis of the discourse, is not actually about loving kindness, and that's often overlooked. And little bit at times, a little bit the fault of the translators into English, but not too much. The discourse is not about loving kindness per se. It talks about it. Certainly, it gives a lot of space to it, but the discourse is really about becoming free. It's about becoming awakened, and the discourse is framed around what is it that helps a person become free. What is it that helps a person become awakened? And it turns out that developing loving kindness, or having a loving, kind heart attitude, is one of the ways, one of the very important foundations for the movement towards freedom. So the discourse goes like this. To reach the state of peace, and this is synonymous with enlightenment, or becoming free or awakened, becoming released. To reach the state of peace, those skilled in the good should be capable and upright, straightforward and easy to speak to, gentle and not proud, contented and easily supported, living lightly and with few duties, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed for supporters, and they should not do the least thing that the wise would criticize. They should reflect, may all beings be happy and secure. May all beings be happy at heart. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, large, medium or short, tiny or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere. Let no one through anger or aversion wish for others to suffer. As a mother would risk her own life to protect her child, her only child, so toward all living beings should one cultivate a boundless heart. With loving kindness for the whole world should one cultivate a boundless heart. Above, below, and all around, without obstruction, without hate, and without ill will. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, as long as one is alert, may one stay with this recollection. This is called the sublime abiding here and now. Whoever is virtuous, endowed with vision, not taken by views, and having overcome all greed for sensual pleasure, will not be reborn again, will be free. And so about maybe over half the discourse, maybe two-thirds of it, is about loving kindness, and with the instruction to reflect on all beings in a kind way, wishing for them, wishing for others to be happy. It's a wish, it's an aspiration that the heart can have, that our minds can have. When we encounter someone else, we might wish for them to be happy, or we might wish everyone to be happy, or to be safe. Secure is the word here in this translation. It's not a moral imperative that a person needs to do this. However, in the context of this discourse, if a person wants to attain liberation, wants to become free, this is one of the ways to do that, is to cultivate a kind heart. a loving heart. There's something about the nature of freedom, the kind of spiritual freedom, that goes hand in hand with having some kind of kindness or kind regard, a goodwill towards others, develop goodwill. Now, I know that there's plenty of people who think that they can cultivate a spiritual life without being concerned about other people. Some people, for many reasons, want to just be left alone. And kind of meditation, people do meditation in particular. They sit down and close their eyes, and the last thing they want to do is relate to anybody. That happens sometimes. But here, having a relationship of goodwill is taken to be essential for part of the process to becoming free. The image that's used for the kind of goodwill discussed here is that of a mother protecting her child, her only child. So it's kind of sometimes called maternal or parental love. The kind of love that wants to take care of or protect or bring security and happiness to the people under their protection, under their care. It's sometimes pointed out that in spiritual circles, there are different kinds of love that are sometimes championed. And sometimes there is a kind of love that is quite passionate. Like a person has this passionate love towards some deity. And the idea is to have all this love and to merge with a deity or with a being. Forget oneself in it. It's kind of this grand love affair. Kind of, I don't know if romantic love is the right word, but sometimes the way it manifests itself, the way it feels, it's almost sexual and the kind of the passion and the absorption and losing oneself. The love that's being talked about here is not one where we lose ourselves in the process or merge and kind of forget ourselves or disappear in the process, but rather it's a love that, kind of, again, like a mother who's watching over distinct and separate from the child, but is there to have the presence of mind to take care of the child and be concerned with the child's goodwill. So for me at least, that image is one that's much more peaceful. The parent needs to stay somewhat balanced, sane, peaceful, present. If the parent loses him or herself in the child's going to be in trouble in various ways. So there's a tremendous outpouring of goodwill in the ideal parent, but there's also a sense of being somewhat distinct in order to be able to offer that care, or calm, or peaceful in the process. And a little bit it makes sense, because the process of becoming free in Buddhism is one that requires us to stay present, to stay cognizant and aware of what's going on. The idea of losing ourselves in something, abandoning ourselves in something, whether it's anything at all, might be nice in various contexts, but it's not really that helpful along the path to freedom, because freedom requires us to stay alert, aware, cognizant to what is happening all the time. There's a lot of different states, so-called spiritual states or altered states that spiritual seekers will enter into and go into. And it's interesting that Buddhism has this big map of mental states, spiritual states, meditation states that it maps out. But certain states that are not covered, are not included in this. So for example, shamanic states, where there, again, where there's kind of a loss of consciousness, loss of awareness, where perhaps like you sense the spirit of an animal enters into the person, and the person comes out of that experience and doesn't really remember what happened, or did it drop suddenly? What happens, Lynn, is that we're having some difficulty with the speaker, and so what happens is it has a mind of its own, and so it goes up and down. So what you need to do is just move up and down with it. Now we're up. We're up now. I think we're too high now. That's good? Okay. So, sorry, be patient while we get it all sorted out. So this value that Buddhism puts on being present and being clear of what's going on all the time is also comes across here in the way it champions love or loving kindness or goodwill. That this is also very important, has calm presence here also. One of the things I find remarkable about the goodwill, the attitude of loving kindness that is talked about in Buddhism, is that it doesn't require an object. It doesn't require having a person that we can. One of the possibilities is to turn the speaker off over there. Do you know how to do that? Yeah, you know. We just turn it off. And if you, those of you up there can't hear, you can move. Because there's lots of space. And so let's see. If that. So now we have to go up a little bit. Now you go up so the other speakers can carry the load. So let's see. I can't stop and listen. How's that? Does that work for people? That's a little bit of feedback now. Is this good now? Does this seem okay? Should we try that so it's off there now? So let's see how that is and see if it makes a difference. We have suspect it's that speaker. And so if we... can you hear okay? Does it work? Okay. So the loving kindness that's talked about doesn't require a person as the object. It often has it, and it's often that's part of the strength of it and the beauty of it. But it doesn't require an object. And my own experience, my own discovery of this feeling of goodwill or loving kindness happened somewhat spontaneously. My original introduction to Buddhism, my first years of practice, was in the Zen tradition. And they never talked about loving kindness that I knew of. And did they ever talk about that? No. I never heard of it. No one said anything about it. And then I went to Thailand and Burma to practice. And my teachers there didn't talk about it much because I was doing intensive mindfulness practice. But in the context of doing intensive mindfulness practice, at some point, all the tremendous amount of love and goodwill welled up inside of me. And I said, what's this? And this feels good. And it felt very joyful, very light, very free. It happened to me in particular when the experience of impermanence was really strong in meditation, kind of a meditative experience of everything kind of just dissolving and disappearing, dissolving, disappearing. And some people get frightened at this point in meditation when things are just disappearing. And for me, it was a little bit the opposite, that it was just very joyful to have this experience. And with that joy came this tremendous sense of love and well-being. And it's like almost anything I turned my attention to, I just fell in love with. You know, whether it was an itch or whether it was a sound or another person, everything was just, I just felt all this goodwill, love towards everything that was. And I thought it was interesting, and I didn't make too much of it. I thought this is interesting and nice. And then, after practicing in Southeast Asia, I came back to America and did a 3-month retreat in IMS in Massachusetts, the first time with Western teachers. It's a little bit odd, isn't it? Yeah. So. If you're too troubled by it, then we'll try turning it off and I'll try to speak loudly. But are we being patient enough with it, the speaker? So, so when I came to IMS, I don't know when, but after a few weeks into the retreats, the teachers came into the hall one day during one of the sittings and said, we're now going to do a guided meditation on loving kindness. And I couldn't believe it. Because I had been doing Zen practice all these years. And the last thing you want to do is, teachers don't talk in the meditation hall during meditation. And just a stare, kind of, silent sitting. And when I was in Asia, the teachers there didn't do guided meditations. Mostly I sat alone in my room. And there was no guided meditation at all there. And but my first contact with this was when I went to IMS. In the middle of this retreat, the teachers showed up and said, we're going to talk during the sitting. While you're meditating, we're going to talk, and we're going to do this guided meditation. And, I'm like, what? you know, that was a completely foreign idea to me. And so I just did, you know, what some people do when I try to do guided meditations. I tune the teacher out. You know, I'm not going to do that. And anyway, that was sentimental. You know, it's kind of sentimental kind of approach to Buddhism, and it's kind of artificial. You know, try to arouse loving kindness and make it happen. And love doesn't work that way. Love is something that kind of is there naturally, or can, I don't know how it happens, but you don't manufacture it. It seems completely insincere. And also disturbing my meditation was not very appreciated. So I just tuned them out. And then as the retreats went along, the same thing happened as happened in Burma, is that as I started kind of relaxing very deeply, and the crusts of the heart started to dissolve, and kind of the fixation in the mind and the heart, and that kind of often is an obstruction for love, when as they started falling away, then what seemingly is kind of like almost an innate quality of the heart, qualities of love or well-being or joy, started rising and bubbling up. And then when the teachers came into the hall to do loving kindness, said, oh, that's what they're talking about. Mm. And then I just piggybacked, I just kind of, or I don't know how to say it, then when they did it, they were just speaking to me through what was already happening. It wasn't about trying to make something happen. It was already happening, and I got kind of like a little, you know, little encouragement, or a little kind of, you know, got to indulge in it a little bit more. You know, it was kind of nice. It's a beautiful thing to have goodwill, to have loving kindness for anybody and for nobody, to have it for no reason at all, to just sit there and have this feeling of goodwill, that feeling of delight, of love. It's not so easy to have it. And it's not easy because we tend to be so fixated, so preoccupied with a lot of our concerns, a lot of our fears, a lot of our desires and ambitions, what we want. Having a lot of wants is one of the primary obstacles to feeling love, to feeling happy. That's what, you know, a lot of people say, right? So if we're constantly going around wanting things, then it's hard to relax and let something inside of us come out of us, bubble up. If we're always trying to fix things or plan or remember, it's hard to make space in the psyche for something to bubble up from inside of us. If we're always trying to protect ourselves, looking out to how, you know, or building ourselves up, or always trying to get something from what's going on, you know, there's no space. We're kind of filled the psychic space, and so something can't bubble up. Sometimes in life, like for example in meditation, when it goes really well and deep, there's letting go of a lot of the fixations, a lot of the preoccupations, a lot of the fear, a lot of the resistance, a lot of things that cover over what's deep inside. And that what's deep inside has a chance more and more to come out, surface. And one of the things that can come out is the kind of love or lightness or delight or goodwill that sometimes is connected to loving kindness, or sometimes in our tradition called loving kindness. One of the qualities of this loving kindness, in Pali it's called metta, is that it's concerned for the welfare of others. It's concerned for their happiness. It's not the same as compassion. Compassion is also concerned about someone's welfare, but it's concerned about the welfare of someone who's suffering and wanting them to be free of that suffering. Goodwill, or loving kindness here, is a little bit different in that the person doesn't have to be suffering, but we just know that someone's there. We want them to be happy. We want some positive experience for them, as opposed to you know, just absence of suffering. So may they be happy. May they be peaceful. The word metta is a cognate, or it's a closely connected word for friend, which the word is mitta. So it's a kind of idea of friendliness, friendly goodwill to someone else, with someone else. Now that someone else can be yourself. And in fact, the way that this is done, the loving kindness practice is done as a formal meditation practice. And it's done in a sequence. There's a classic sequence in how it's done. And it's first done by cultivating loving kindness towards oneself, having goodwill towards oneself. And for some people, that's phenomenally healing to do that. It's a radical thing for some psyches to turn away or drop the self-criticalness, the self-loathing, the self, you know, all these problems we have with ourselves, to drop it or turn it around and instead have a sense of goodwill and love and delight and appreciation for ourselves. So that's where it begins. And then it goes to someone who's a friend. Next it goes to someone who's a benefactor, someone who's helped you somehow in your life. Then it goes to a friend, and then it goes to a neutral person, and then it goes to, the classic expression is enemy. In the West, we don't like to use that word, so we say a difficult person. So there's that sequence, that direction. It goes from self, benefactor, friend, neutral person, and difficult person. In the ancient world, the assumption here, it's explicit in the teachings, is that you start where it's easiest. And so the assumption is that for everybody, it's easiest to start with themselves. So that's what, you know, it's obvious, right? That's where you should. So there's an ancient story at the time of the Buddha of a king, great king, who lived there at the time, you know. And it helps the story if you fill in some of it, maybe imagine some of it, that he was somewhat arrogant. You know, everybody was in the king of the land, you know, strong, great conqueror, kind of emperor kind of guy. And he, you know, was used to people, everybody kind of kissed up to him and, you know, revered him and thought he was the best and the greatest. Maybe it was a little bit dangerous for your life not to do that. So that's what he was used to. Let's see. So one day, he's out on the... He was staying together with the queen in the upper palace. And the king said to the queen, "Is there anyone more dear to you than yourself?" So here's this guy, right? Is anybody more important to you than yourself? Well, he's standing there waiting for the answer, right? The husband, the king, you know, anybody, you know. And she says, "No, Your Majesty. There is no one more dear to me than myself." She then asked him the same question. "Is there anyone more dear to you than yourself, dear?" "No, Queen, there is no one more dear to me than myself." The king then left the palace and went to the Buddha. Maybe in the story you should imagine, the king left in a huff and went to the Buddha. On arriving, he bowed and sat to one side. The king then told the Buddha of his exchange with the queen. So this was important enough that he wanted to check this out with the Buddha. Understanding the importance of this, the Buddha then stated, "If you surveyed the entire world, you would find no one more dear than yourself. Since each person is most dear to themselves, may those who love themselves not bring harm to anyone." So there's a wonderful thing here the Buddha's doing. It's also, he's talking to a king who has blood on his hands. Goes around conquering, right? So a little bit, that's also you have to remember when he makes this little verse. It's a verse, the end, last story. So first he agrees with the queen that everyone is most dear to themselves. And then he does something the Buddha likes to do. He says, you kind of like you put someone else in, yourself in other people's shoes, kind of exchange of using others, to compare yourself to others, or understand others by understanding yourself. Since that is true, since each person loves themselves, they shouldn't harm anybody else, is the conclusion you want to make. Since you love yourself and other people love themselves the same as you love yourself, They had that same sense of want for the desire for their own happiness, the same goodwill, same care for themselves as you have for yourself, O King. Do not harm any of them. Do not harm anyone. So the assumption here is that it's a worthwhile, it's appropriate, it's expected that people cherish themselves, have some kind of love or goodwill, friendliness towards themselves. For some people I know, it's easy to have goodwill or compassion for everybody but themselves. For some reason, this person here doesn't count. Like, we're not really the, you know, everybody else is, you know, nice humans. And now who knows who this person is? You know, it's like, somehow we don't count, you know. But each person, in Buddhism, each person counts, in a sense, equally. Everyone's worthy of love, of kindness, including ourselves. So we start with ourselves. Some people here in the West, I know, take the principle of starting loving kindness practice where it's easiest and start with a benefactor or start with a friend. And then they somehow follow the sequence, they kind of mix it all up according to what works best for them. So hopefully they don't have to wait for themselves. Hopefully they are not their own most difficult person. They don't have to wait that long. But eventually, the idea is to do all these five categories of beings in loving kindness practice. Learn how to cultivate an open heart, a generous heart, a friendly heart to all these categories of people. And then the practice is to do what's called breaking down the barriers. And that is, in a sense, to imagine yourself, a benefactor, a friend, a neutral person, and a difficult person all standing in front of you. And then cultivating an equal loving kindness to each one. So there's no distinction between any of them. You have the same level of goodwill to each of them. One way of understanding this, which I think maybe is helpful and I think to me is inspiring, is that we start with what's easy. We start with where love is easy. Hopefully everyone has some place to love that's easy. So I know one person did loving kindness, some people who did loving kindness practice, and they started with their dog. And then, it's kind of cliche that some people say that, once they do their dog, then they try to see themselves in the way their dog sees them. It's unconditioned love, you know. The dog doesn't care if you come home grumpy or, you know, you didn't take out the garbage or whatever. The dog loves you anyway. So I know some people do the dog. But the idea is to take what you can do, so do yourself or do your family or do the person you love, And then universalize it. So you're not asked to deny or let go of your love for other people, but you're asked to clarify it, to purify it, and then to universalize it. So everyone can be in that field. Everyone can be included. Now part of that task is to purify it, to clarify that love. And it's very common that most people, when they love each other, that there's a level of attachment or clinging or fear in that relationship. And so much so that I think some people, it's inconceivable how they could love without some attachment or some clinging as part of it. We're clinging to being seen a certain way, we're clinging to getting love in return, we're clinging to that person's presence, we're clinging to what, you know, all kinds of things we're clinging to the pleasure of it, to the joy of it, to the validation we get from it, all kinds of things. The task in a spiritual path that's leading to freedom, the task here is to find love, discover that capacity of love that has no clinging in it. So that's a big challenge for people in intimate relationships or not in intimate relationships who want to be. There can be so much clinging. So the spiritual path and moving towards freedom is to somehow try to separate out the wheat from the chaff, to separate out, you know, so that the clinging is not, you know, part of our goodwill, part of our love. It's really hard to see. So part of the function of loving kindness practice is to help us begin discovering a kind of goodwill that hopefully is without clinging, without expectation, without demand, just a kind of a natural, easy goodwill. Doing loving kindness practice does entail having a wish, and the wish is that of wishing someone else happiness. If there's an expectation for that, then it's considered to be a form of clinging. So how to have the wish, kind of open-ended wish, without expecting it, without being disappointed if it doesn't happen? Just have this kind of boundless, open goodwill. May kind of like you say in theistic religions, may that person be happy, God willing. So just kind of, this is my wish, but I'm not in charge, I'm not in control. Causes and conditions are going to come together, and it may or may not happen, but it's my expression. When I've done loving kindness practice, one of the things that's helped me a lot, a little idea that's helped me, is to remember a time in my life where I heard that a third party, someone who's not present, had inquired about my welfare. Someone, maybe even someone who I didn't expect cared about me. You know, how's Gil? Is he okay? What's he up to? And I feel kind of a happiness, a delight, knowing someone else has that kind of enough care, enough goodwill towards me that they ask about me when I'm not there. That happiness that I feel has been a guide for me to then feeling happiness or feeling sense of lightness or delight when I'm doing loving kindness practice, when I'm doing it to myself, when I'm doing it to others. That reminder, there's a possibility of a certain lightness of being or ease or inspiration that comes when this beautiful thing happens, when someone has goodwill, is concerned with the welfare of others. There is a tendency sometimes for people to think that all of our personal problems, all the hindrances to a spiritual life, can be overcome by doing mindfulness practice. And if you just be mindful enough, everything will resolve itself. So there's a very interesting dialogue that goes back to, that the Buddha was in. And this is maybe, I don't know, maybe this is... This dialogue had to do with a tree spirit. So the Buddha was somewhere, and this tree spirit came to see the Buddha. And a tree spirit said basically this thing, that mindfulness is all you need. So the tree spirit said, things are always good for one who is mindful. The mindful one grows in happiness. Each day improves for one who is mindful. The mindful one is free from hate. The Buddha then replied, repeating some of what the tree spirit said. Things are always good for one who is mindful. The mindful one will grow in happiness. Each day improves for one who is mindful, but the mindful one is not free from hate. The person who day and night delights in harmlessness and has loving kindness towards all beings is the one who has no hate for anyone. So mindfulness here says not enough, but in order to overcome hate or ill will, loving kindness is the antidote, is the medicine. So that to cultivate, to develop it, to make space for it. So the idea of cultivating and developing a capacity for love or goodwill is a very important aspect of Buddhist practice. I've found it invaluable for myself, and a lot of people have found it really valuable. The suggestion is that sooner or later, as you develop a path of freedom, goodwill, a sense of goodwill, you have to make space for it. You at least have to allow for it to happen. But perhaps you can don't have to leave it to chance or wait that long, but it actually you can kind of preempt it a little bit by seeing what you could do to cultivate it and develop it. So there is a meditation practice called meditation on loving kindness that's done in order to develop it and grow it. That meditation on loving kindness is the companion meditation to the mindfulness meditation here at IMC or in the Vipassana world. So two primary meditations that we do is mindfulness and loving kindness. Loving kindness is understood to be the source of all healthy relatedness. All healthy emotional feelings of healthy relatedness we have towards others. Loving kindness is the source for feeling compassion. Loving kindness is the source for feeling sympathetic joy in others. Loving kindness is the source for feeling what's called grandmotherly love. Grandmotherly love is the kind of love a grandmother feels for her grandchildren, but the grandmother has seen it all before. And so doesn't get caught up and anxious around what the little dramas around the grandchildren, the way the parents do. So it's a kind of more even, balanced, kind of equanimous love, the grandmotherly love. I wanted to read you the benefits. There's many benefits to doing loving kindness practice, but there's a list that's kind of nice. One sleeps happily. One wakes happily. One has no bad dreams. One is loved by others. One is loved by non-humans. One is protected by the devas. Fire, poison, or swords won't touch one. One's mind becomes concentrated quickly. One's complexion becomes clear. One dies with a mind free from confusion. And if no higher attainment is reached, when one dies, one is reborn in the heavenly realms. That's pretty good list of things, doing it. One sleeps happily and wakes happily. A couple of other small quotes, and then we'll stop. Loving kindness is called, metta is called loving kindness because it is loving. It refers to tender or lubricating love. It is also known as metta because it arises in one's relationship to a friend, mitta. The characteristic of loving kindness is to promote well-being. It functions to prefer well-being. Its manifestation is the removal of annoyance. Its proximate cause is seeing the loveliness of beings. To see the loveliness of beings. Isn't that a great expression? So to look at someone and see their loveliness. You know, it's kind of like people watching. But you don't look, you know, what you're looking for is what's beautiful. Not, you know, externally. But can you look kind of through their eyes, or can you look under the skin and see what's lovely? And the idea here is that everyone has loveliness, has inner beauty. Maybe it's covered over or forgotten, they don't know about it themselves. But to see it, to see the preciousness of other people. And to see that, to begin seeing it, being awakening to it, is the proximate cause for loving kindness. It succeeds when it makes ill will subside. And it fails when it produces selfish affection. Loving kindness towards the world is happiness for those whose hearts bend kindly to all beings. Can you read it again? Beautiful. Loving kindness towards the world is happiness for those whose hearts bend kindly to all beings. So if your heart can bend kindly toward all beings, then if you have loving kindness, that kindness will be your happiness. So may it be. May each of you know some of this happiness. And if you know the possibility of happiness, the capacity of happiness that's in every person's heart, may it be your delightful aspiration, your inspired aspiration, to be a promoter of happiness in all beings. so that everyone can be happy and sleep happily and wake up happily. So, thank you very much.